The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com. 11 minutes after 8, and I'm really proud to bring some attention, put a little love on a policy paper which has come out from the Manhattan Institute. Carolyn Gorman is a policy analyst with that great institute. Carolyn, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Thanks so much for having me and for your attention to this issue.
Yeah, this just came out this morning and it popped in my email box. And I think, gosh, you know, I have an opening. I'd like to talk with Carolyn about this, but it has to do with school-based mental health programs. And there has been a big push to have the kids, examining or being aware of mental health problems with their students. And I don't know how I ever graduated from school without having a mental health program shoved at me, but apparently it's a different world. But there's been billions of dollars being funneled into schools over mental health. Could you set the table in what your study is discovering?
Yeah, definitely. So you're exactly right. There's a lot of conversation right now going on around youth mental health, and a lot of proposed solutions are to put more mental health programs and services into schools. But there are real downsides to this approach that I think deserve more attention, and we're making a big trade-off with other programs and services that can be provided through schools, because schools have limited resources. And as you may know, right now we're having a hard enough time just sort of fulfilling the primary goal of education to give academic learning to kids. So we really want to kind of weigh the trade-offs of anything that we're going to be putting in schools that's not related to kind of the core education mission.
What does it normally mean when they talk about school-based mental health? How is it currently defined in most school districts around the country?
All differently, and that's part of the problem. There's no sort of consistent set of programs or services that are supposed to make up some sense of a comprehensive structure or system of school-based mental health. Now, all these school-based programs essentially do the same thing. They try to increase awareness of mental disorders and try to encourage paying attention to emotional states in order to direct more kids and teens towards mental health services with the hopes of preventing mental health conditions upstream. Now, this might not be a bad plan if we knew what caused mental illnesses, or if mental health treatment was highly effective, or even if these programs had a good track record of successful implementation in schools, but none of that is true.
All right. When it comes to mental health programs, there is no standard then as to what a school-based mental health program would look like, right? I just want to be clear.
That's right. But a lot of times these services are sort of superficial and serving kids on a universal basis. So they're superficial, high-level programs that go to all students, as opposed to targeted direct services to kids who really have the most serious need for mental health intervention.
All right. Now, what role does, and maybe you can help us understand, you'll hear some gobbledygook out there, a term called social emotional learning. Could you help us understand this? Because it's a buzz phrase, which is in a lot of these kind of programs.
Yeah, again, I think that's part of the problem. There are so many different types of social emotional learning programs. A lot of times they're kind of distinctly packaged, commercially available curriculum. And because there's such a wide set of this stuff, it's really hard to know, you know, what's actually helpful and what's not. On net, though, again, the sort of primary purpose is to kind of help people understand their emotional states, be aware of those. And honestly, the other kind of problem that I have with social emotional learning is because they're so vague, it's hard to assess, one. And two, schools, in my mind, are inherently places where students are going to socially and emotionally develop and learn just by nature of being there and being around their peers.
Sure.
So it's not clear to me that, you know, teachers need to be trained in providing these distinctly packaged programs to know, you know, how they should be providing those opportunities to students, just by nature of, you know, giving kids academic challenges, we're putting them in a position to help grow.
Is there a is one of the reasons they're trying to shove so much mental health training or mental health programs into the government school system, Carolyn, that they're trying to reduce violence? And I'm thinking about, you know, when you have kids that go bubble off plum and they go shoot the school up. We just had some of this happen again just recently. And there seemed to be common threads that everybody knew this kid was a problem. Everyone's known about it. FBI knew about it. Nothing was done, et cetera, et cetera. Is it trying to head that sort of stuff off, or are we talking about more run-of-the-mill of people fight, or they're depressed about school or something? You know, how should we think about this?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. Those types of situations, when we have had those situations in the past, these kind of universal mental health and wellness programs have sort of been a hallmark of federal responses to those situations. Mm-hmm. The problem is, you've just said it, we almost always know exactly who those individuals are already. We don't need to kind of be given mental health literacy training to understand, you know, this kid definitely needs more support. So all these programs are doing is actually making it harder to stop and prevent those types of incidents because they're increasing false positives.
Oh, is it kind of the assumption that you're a kid and you're on social media, so you must already be partially mentally ill? Is that kind of almost where you're going?
Well, that's a whole other thing. But no, in almost all cases where there has been a mass school shooting, that child has already been reported for having some type of issue, has posted publicly about their plans, is well known to social services, or has received mental health treatment services. So we don't actually need a lot of help identifying the kids who really have the most serious problems.
Are we just bad about actually delivering services to the people who we already know are really in trouble?
That's right. And these programs, these sort of universal, widespread mental health programs, make doing that even harder because they're misallocating resources away from the kids who need it most and towards kids who don't need it and can even be harmed by it.
Carolyn Gorman is with me. She's written an amazing policy paper here. It's called School-Based Mental Health Initiatives, Challenges and Considerations for Policymakers. And you can find this on the Manhattan.Institute website. I'll put this all up on KMED.com, of course, on the guest's information. I'm just kind of curious. When you have a system that has been taking billions of federal dollars and doing these broad-based programs that according to your study, have been relatively ineffective, is there a possibility, I'm just raising the possibility, that a lot of what is considered mental health treatment is being directed at people who may be just, shall we say, rebellious or, you know, or now they call that oppositional defiance disorder, you know, that kind of thing. In other words, people that look at the government school system, which really isn't a natural environment for most anybody who is creative and, you know what I'm getting at here? I'm kind of saying that the standard classroom is not necessarily great for a lot of people, but yet that's where they're
forced.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. And unfortunately, I think providing these sort of superficial programs is also a problem of accountability. It sort of takes the pressure off of schools, off of the mental health system, to really sort of address these challenges, because a lot of times now a diagnosis is sort of the thing that gets a student access to resources that they wouldn't otherwise.
Is there a big push to medicate children in these programs, these broad-based school mental health programs? Do you know?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
These broad-based programs are more, again, sort of superficial, high-level, think of how you're feeling. The idea of this is to kind of try to identify sooner when someone might be experiencing feelings that are abnormal so that we can then push those students towards mental health treatment. The problem is, you know, what is normal? A lot of times, even some bad behavior is normal. I think you've just said it yourself. You know, if a kid is sort of having a hard time sitting still in class all day, is that maybe something that we should just expect of, you know, a young preteen boy, for example?
So
over the course of the last few decades, we've come to really sort of medicalize normal emotional responses, and that has pushed more kids into treatment. So, yeah, there's a lot of there are a lot of young people who are now taking stimulants and antidepressants, and these are serious medications that we want to be thoughtful about before giving them to kids who might not have any issue but are just sort of developing. And so we should be wary of how many kids are actually in mental health treatment. And what is our goal? You know, 1 in 3 kids received services, professional services or medical treatment for mental disorders last year.
Are you serious? Wait a minute.
That's according to the National Survey of Health and Substance Use out of SAMHSA.
Oh, okay. Now, hold on. I'm hearing that from you, Carolyn Gorman, by the way, with the Manhattan Institute. You're trying to tell me that all of a sudden we now have 1 out of 3 children in trouble each year and being treated for mentally, that all of a sudden the culture is pumping out 1 out of 3 kids that are having super problems? Wow.
I think definitionally that tells us that these are not actually abnormal problems. And so we should be very wary about making sure that we are, you know, thinking about what a real problem is, what a real problem is not. And one problem with too great a focus on, you know, mental health and wellness and emotional states is it sends a message to kids and teachers and parents that they are at risk of developing disorders, you know, if they have any negative emotions. I think this is just untrue. It's at odds with kind of the realities of being a human.
Yeah.
And it's worrying.
And let's be honest that, sometimes you could be depressed about something because you have a reason to be depressed about something, not because you have a shortage of an SSRI and you need to get it from your mental health provider, you know?
I think that's exactly right. It makes total sense to me that rates of distress reported among youth were higher during the pandemic. Those rates are already going down, but think about what was going on during the pandemic.
Uh-huh.
Students were sort of holed up in their rooms, doom scrolling through social media. It makes sense that they were, you know, not feeling great during that time.
Yeah, and they were also being told that being social with real people was instant death, right? You know, and that they were going to kill grandma by actually being social, that sort of thing. There's all sorts of stuff they were told that just wasn't so.
That's right. So I think we should be thoughtful and kind of try to use a framework of what's normal, what do we expect people to feel before we jump right into giving all these kids mental health treatment.
Wouldn't it be smarter to just, you know, instead of trying to provide this in the school, just refer people, you know, children who we think are seriously in trouble and need some help to professionals? Why does it have to be provided in the school? That's a serious question. Why?
A lot of advocates think that it makes sense to provide these services through schools because that's where kids are. It's going to be the easiest place to deliver these services to kids. And I think there is some warrant to thinking about the structural concern of for those kids who really do warrant mental health services. You know, transportation might be a problem. Those types of challenges do exist.
Okay.
But the kids with the most serious mental health challenges, those kids who sort of warrant considering the benefits of getting mental health treatment, they're least likely to be served in a typical neighborhood public school.
And that's kind of what I was wondering. If you have children that are facing that much of a mental health crisis, they shouldn't be there.
Exactly. And I think that's another reason why directing resources, public funding towards school-based mental health programs that are universal, trying to serve everyone, are really harmful for kids who need a lot of support and aren't getting it.
And I would imagine that part of this, though, is driven by the agenda that superintendents and principals and everybody, they want that kid in the school, in their school, because there's state money attached to that every day they're there. That's usually the way it's covered in most school districts. And I'm wondering if this is why they're like, hey, we need this mental health thing. Nobody gets kicked out. Nobody leaves. And, you know, they're all, hey, you're dealing with here, and we still get your money. I'm a little cynical about that. I'm just wondering if there's any evidence of that, you know, going on.
Look, I want to assume the best intent from everyone. And I've spoken to so many school administrators and teachers and school counselors, school psychologists, school professionals. They really want the best interest for kids. And I think it's worth trying to help those who do want to do the best for kids by helping them understand the real trade-offs that are being made by offering these programs. These sort of harms for doing these types of programs and the ineffectiveness of a lot of these programs, they're not being talked about a lot of times by the mental health industry, because the mental health industry benefits by getting these programs out there into as many schools as possible.
Yeah.
So it's important, I think, to sort of lay out these trade-offs and these downsides so that school administrators sort of have a better understanding of what's at risk and how much it might actually help students or not.
Well, Carolyn, obviously you're a much nicer person than me because I take a more jaundiced view of bureaucracies, but that's okay. All right. That being said, what would you suggest for reform here, given that there have been billions of dollars setting these mental health programs up in practically every district?
Yeah, well, first, I think the public mental health system has a responsibility to serve the kids who have the most serious emotional disturbances. That is the responsibility of the public mental health system. For schools, they still need some solutions, and I would encourage more structural interventions like after-school programs or even literacy programs for students who are, you know, feeling distressed because they're still not doing well or caught up from learning losses during the pandemic.
Still.
Even things like weapons bans or phone bans, these are all sort of structural interventions that schools are just going to be much more equipped to do well and are going to do more for, you know, the broader student body than trying to provide mental health treatment or push kids towards mental health treatment, which isn't actually that effective in general.
It's interesting that you brought up the phone bans because we have some districts here in Southern Oregon that are engaging in that for the first time now. And it'll be interesting to see where that goes to try to reduce the distractions and get people actually concentrating on their academics, perhaps with fewer distractions. Maybe there's more achievement. And with more achievement, maybe there's less of a possibility of mental health trouble, maybe?
Yeah, look, I think I'm in support of sort of bottom-up initiatives, grassroots initiatives of parents saying, hey, you know what? I don't think we want our kids doing this. I don't think it makes sense to have these in schools, and having sort of school-level buy-in. I think that's a really great idea. From a classroom management perspective alone, I think not having phones in the classroom are a good thing. I think we should be wary of kind of unintended consequences of mandates, because there are going to be some parents who might want their kids to have their phones. But overall, the early evidence, the early research evidence does suggest some benefit to these phone bans. And so I think it's worth communicating that information to parents and schools that they can, you know, together agree on what makes sense for their district.
We're back with Carolyn Gorman, who's a policy analyst with the Manhattan Institute, and she has a new report out there evaluating school-based mental health initiatives. And the paper says that using the school systems to administer mental health services, there's challenges and consequences of it, and not all good. We've been talking about this for the last few minutes. And Francine, I'm happy to take your call or question with Carolyn Gorman. Go right ahead. What's up?
More than a question, I have a commentary here, because the records that public schools have of dealing with mental health with their students has gotten worse and worse and worse over the past 20 years. They've gone from I mean, you're talking about people that are telling children that, oh, you're probably really not a girl, you're really a boy. I mean, this is what schools have been encouraging, mental illness, for a long time now. And now they're going to sit there and take over the having to cure these mental illnesses. And it seems to me this is just another way of the state taking children, you know, away from their parents.
All family. Right. Francine, I appreciate that. What do you think about that, Carolyn? In fact, in Oregon, that has been a big aspect of a lot of conversation about mental health is the so-called gender-affirming care in the transgender contagion, which seems to have exploded out of nowhere over the last decade. Is there any connection with some of these programs in the past? I'm just curious. Do you know?
Yeah, so this is outside of my sort of primary research interest, but I will say I think it's important to consider what the impact of normalizing various emotional responses and mental disorders has been. You know, we've sort of tried to destigmatize mental illnesses, but in a lot of ways, that's almost glamorized mental illness for kids. And it's almost become something that kids talk about as if it's a part of their identity. You know, like, I have this diagnosis or I have that diagnosis. And kids are putting this, like, on their dating profiles. So I think we should be wary of, you know, sort of over-normalizing mental disorders for sake of increasing access to treatment. You know, for an adult with serious mental illness who's digging through the dumpster because he thinks the government has planted a transmitter there and is listening to his conversations, that guy is not getting mental health treatment because, you know, he's worried about what people think of him. And so sort of promoting this normalization too early and too young among kids, I think, does have some negative consequences.
Francine, I appreciate your question. And I also appreciate you saying it's not your wheelhouse, but you're able to draw some reasonable conclusions from what you have studied. Let me go to Steve, Wild Salmon Steve. Steve, you're on with Carolyn Gorman from the Manhattan Institute. What's your question?
Well, when it comes to the government deciding things, they make boxes and they put everybody into a box. And if you fit within the middle part, then you're a normal student. If you're on either side, then you get ignored. We had two kids. The oldest boy was in junior high. They were going to put him in a mentally retarded class because he wasn't paying attention in class, and he was kind of an irritation to the teachers. And my wife finally just harassed and raised all kinds of hell with him and got them to have him do an IQ test. And it turns out he's like two standard deviations above the norm for IQ. He was just bored.
Huh.
And my youngest son was like in second grade, and he was having a terrible time. He was irritating the teachers because he kept writing backwards. And a lady who was an ex-teacher that was doing Cub Scouts or something noticed that if he wrote with his left hand, he would write backwards. If he wrote with his right hand, he would write forwards. He simply was totally ambidextrous. He didn't see the difference.
That's fascinating.
That is.
You know, isn't it, you know, Carolyn, Steve's conversation makes me wonder if, you know, a lot of people who are just not being satisfied by the public school system and the style and the way things are done, this is kind of like going back being bored in the class, end up being diagnosed or shoved into those universal mental illness kind of programs that have been so popular.
Yeah, and there is some evidence of this. For kids who receive medication or ADHD diagnoses, they tend to be in the younger birth months of that grade year. So if schools were not over-identifying and teachers were not over-identifying kids for having ADHD, you would see an even distribution of those kids who have been identified by age within a grade. But because we see that younger students are getting referred more often, I think that's very clear evidence that sort of there's this peer-to-peer comparison going on. And that means that a lot of the wrong kids are going to get pointed towards services when they don't need mental health treatment.
Now, part of your study here is that you believe that these universal programs on mental health literacy the mental health awareness, the suicide awareness, the emotional wellness, that this all needs to be rolled back. And if you're going to advocate that it be rolled back, then is it rolled back and replaced with something, or rolled back and we take a different approach entirely? How would you see this?
Yeah, I think an entirely different approach is needed. We really need to focus on the kids with the most serious mental disorders, kids who sort of have early signs of psychosis. These kids with the most serious emotional disturbances, again, that is the responsibility of the public mental health system. The public education system has a primary responsibility to provide academic learning and preparation for kids to participate in society productively. So for schools, I'd much rather see structural interventions. So interventions like, you know, after school programs or mm-hmm. recess or keeping doors open longer, or even just a stronger commitment to full in-person school days and better enforcement of behavioral codes of conduct and attendance policies. Those types of structural changes, I think, are going to do more for just the overall vibe and feeling that kids have than, you know, giving them worksheets asking to identify emotions. It's also going to help us decrease those false positives, decrease those kids pointed towards treatment that don't need it, which makes it easier to spot when there's actual real problems and real kids who have, you know, serious concern for possibly needing mental health treatment that may unfortunately at some point, you know, be distressed and bring a weapon to school with the intention of using it.
Do you believe that there will be resistance to such proposals? Because generally speaking, as bureaucracies grow and public school systems are certainly very large and self-protecting bureaucracies, you think there'd be a lot of resistance to this, you know, saying, hey, this is something we've been doing for years.
Yeah, look, I think it's tough, right? You definitely have a mental health industry that wants to push these programs because they stand to financially benefit from pushing these programs. But I do think schools, you know, feel almost unfortunately obligated to take this on because the mental health system has not focused on the most serious kids. And so they see these issues, they see these school shootings, and they don't know that there's something better to do. And so I think it's worth kind of raising to schools that there is a better approach, and this kind of promotion of wellness for all is not going to prevent mental illness.
All right. So for the most serious students, you're not trying to take care of them within a school-based system, but you're not against, though, like having a school counselor there, right?
No, not at all. In fact, I think school counselors are really valuable. I think school counselors should primarily focus on academic counseling, mm-hmm. but it's really useful to have that type of support person within a school system, especially when it comes to sort of making those connections with for kids who might need outside resources.
Caroline, great talk, and I appreciate you sharing information about this with us today. Manhattan.institute is the website where this study is. And Carolyn Gorman is the author of this School-Based Mental Health Initiatives, Challenges and Considerations for Policymakers. Thanks so much for having me on the show, and I look forward to what you're working on next. By the way, is there anything you're working on next, or is it still going to be mostly mental health and education?
Mostly mental health. I'm primarily interested in actually the adult population with serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders, and that's because it's worth noting most mental illnesses don't develop for most people until late teens and early 20s, which is another reason that this school-based resource focus is really just poor targeting.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. Great having you on the show. Be well.
Have a good one.
It's 8:42. This is 99.3 KBXG and, of course, 106.3 KMED.
News is sponsored by Valley View Nursery, your only nursery with online pricing. Visit valleyviewnursery.com. They're closer than you think.
From the KMED News Center, including postmarked ballots arriving too late to be counted. Bill London, KMED.
All right. All right. Sorry about that. I'm sitting here talking to people on the phone. I'm looking at things that are going on here. Hey, coming up in about 2-3 minutes, we're going to have the Diner 62 Real American Quiz. If you haven't won this in the last 60 days, you could win it next. Get that $20 gift certificate. Enjoy the Clam Chowder Friday. The Half Ham Special's going on for 11:15. That's Monday through Friday, 6 to 9. And all the other wonderful food that's there. If you're still hungry at Diner 62 when you leave, either you didn't order or there's a hormonal problem. Talk to your endocrinologist. I don't know if I can actually make that diagnosis or not. But jump on it. 770-5633. We'll do that here in about 2-3 minutes. Matt's here. Matt, you wanted to bite about, I think you must have been biting about the mental health conversation with Carolyn from the Manhattan Institute. What's on your mind?
Yeah. Bill, I called you a philosopher in an email, and I think anyone who thinks deeply on particular things and develops their own opinions about it can be considered a philosopher. Whether we're respected as such, that's a whole other case.
Right.
But on this mental illness stuff, you and I have talked about this before. These things didn't exist to the degree that they exist today. And so it's incumbent upon us to say what's changed. But the point I want to make here is I've always thought of the mind as a caged animal. And there's nothing more dangerous than an animal that's been caged or that's you have cornered.
And what, of course, is by definition the public school system?
It is. It is. And so imagine, I remember this awful thing that happened in seventh grade in a locker room where we used to have to shower, and this poor kid, he's almost albino, and you had to take showers, and all these big football guys surrounded him. Sorry, they called him Seymour.
Oh, I remember that kind of stuff going on, yeah.
And I mean,
it was like primed for abuse. It really was.
I sat there. I had a locker next to him, and he and I never really talked at all. But I sat there, and I was like next to him, sitting there with like a towel wrapped around me, and they're screaming at him, and I'm going, "Holy crap, this poor kid!" You know. But when I firmly believe that when you put kids in school and they're caged, like you could almost even picture them in a glass jar, and they're in that jar, they can't see outside. They don't see an escape for themselves. And so the longer you go without having an escape, the more compressed your feelings become. It's like a spring. And then eventually you snap. Now, some kids snap, they develop mental illnesses. Some kids snap, they take a gun to school and they kill a couple of students or some other people, the teachers maybe. I think one of the biggest problems that we have is there is no escape. And now that you're taking all of that pressure of being in school and from, you know, things that go on there, and you're throwing a cell phone in it with unlimited access to some of the worst things on the face of the planet on the internet. And you've got this stew of just absolute mental illness. And it's almost a wonder how any kid avoids not being nuts in today's world. And I think what has to happen, these outbound programs, you know, people used to joke about them, you know, do comedy skits and stuff. The fact is, if you take, I've seen these kids, you take them out of the inner city, for example, where all they know is gang violence and being afraid all the time, being gunned down or robbed, and you take them out into the woods and sit them at a campfire. Okay, every noise, every time they hear a branch break, they think it's Sasquatch, right?
Right.
So they're afraid of that. But it is such an escape for a mind, for a child, to grow up in a certain atmosphere where all they feel is this compression and pressure, and you take them somewhere and they say, wow, there's something else. It's not the world I live in is not the world I have to live in. And I think that's gone now. Like, we used to go camping when I was a kid. I love your stories about your Vanagon and all that stuff. We used to camp, Bill.
Yeah. And we didn't think of, well, of course, what does, and I know I'm getting into conspiratorial globalist stack and pack housing, but everything about them is to compress people into smaller and smaller spaces, which humans are really not designed to reside in. We're not, it's not a natural way of existence. And, you know, here we're in a semi-rural area, so we're sort of between the two extremes, really.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, America was developed because people were willing to brave the wilderness, right? You had people who were willing to, you know, cross the Great Plains and then come over the, you know, the Rocky Mountains and the Sierra Nevada and all these things. Where does that exist anymore for most kids?
It doesn't right now. And maybe that's where we need to be looking at as far as mental illness and what we think of as an educational system, and frankly, what we think of is a proper neighborhood and a lifestyle. Good call, and you're always welcome. Very thoughtful, Matt. It's 8:48. Okay, we'll continue this here in just a moment. Diner 62 quiz is the palate cleanser, though. We'll do that next. 770-5633, one line open. We'll do this in a matter of seconds.
This hour of the Bill Myers Show is brought to you by John.
Tickets now at theexpo.com.
This is News Talk 106.3 KMED, and you're waking up with the Bill Myers Show.
Oh, I love this. Merrick Garland on the news channels right now. He will not allow the DOJ to be used as a political weapon. Oh, that's high comedy. Too late, buddy. Too late. You were part of that way in the beginning. I guess we'll hear more about that with Mark Lee Van Camp and Robbins. So I'm sure they'll tear that apart here in just a matter of time. But we have the Diner 62 Real American Quiz. Hey, Tom, how you doing this morning? Welcome.
Just fine, thank you.
Hey, Tom, this Saturday in history, September 14th, 1964, the Kellogg's Company started selling the Pop-Tart. Innovative, portable breakfast treat turned anytime snack, would sell billions a year and help redefine breakfast food. Now, it all started when one of Kellogg's biggest competitors, Post, trumpeted to the press that it had created a new breakfast item, a shelf-stable, fruit-filled, handheld toaster pastry, and they called it Country Squares. Unfortunately, it wasn't quite ready for the market, and Post dragged its feet on the product, and Kellogg's, having heard about the announcement, rushed to put out its own version, beat him to the punch. So, Tom, for the win, which of the following was not one of the four original flavors? Was it A, blueberry, B, cherry, C, apple currant, D, strawberry, or E, brown sugar cinnamon? Which one was not an original flavor of Pop-Tart?
Oh, that's tough. Oh, God.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and the one that I guessed was absolutely wrong, so see what you think.
I'm gonna lose myself. I'll guess cinnamon.
Cinnamon was what I thought it was, and yeah, I was wrong too. I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought, yeah, I'll bet you they didn't do brown sugar cinnamon. But let's see, Jerry. Jerry's in Rogue River. Hey, Jerry, how you doing?
Good morning, Bill.
Blueberry, cherry, apple currant, or strawberry? Which of those four not one of the four original Pop-Tarts?
I think I'm going to try the apple currant.
Apple currant. That sounds kind of way too old-fashioned-y, right? No, they actually had that. They actually had that. Sorry. All right. So apple currant. I want to make sure that we get rid of this. So brown sugar. So we're down to Jack. Hello, Jack. How you doing?
Hey, Bill.
Blueberry, cherry, strawberry. Which of those following not one of the original Pop-Tarts?
Blueberry.
Blueberry. No, they had a blueberry. No problem. All right, let me go to Lauren. All right. Hey, Lauren.
Yes, sir.
Cherry or strawberry, which one not an original Pop-Tart?
I'm going to go with cherry.
You're going to go with cherry?
Yes, sir.
You're having a great day. Pop-Tarts, instant hit, but yeah, it was blueberry, strawberry, apple currant, and brown sugar cinnamon. And they completely sold out of the 45,000 test cases. People loved it. They even had to put out ads saying, hey, we're really sorry, we ran out of Pop-Tarts, right? And then they added cherry and Concord grape, raspberry apple, replaced apple currant. And then there's just a bunch of them. By the way, by 1967, Lauren, Kellogg's figured out a way to add frosting that wouldn't melt in the toaster. And then they had sprinkles and new flavors. And then the goofy mascot, Milton the Toaster. Don't know if you remember that. But by the time Pop-Tarts turned 50 in 2014, dozens of flavors have been added. Sales have grown every year. And according to CNBC, just in 2022, more than 3 billion of those, 3 billion of those. And I got to tell you, you know, they taste great, but boy, they're bad for you. I mean, we know that, right?
No, they're loaded with sugar. Yeah, I know, man.
Absolutely, but yet I love them, and which is why I stay away from them. But there we go, $3 billion a year. Hang on, my friend, you're going to Diner 62. It's 8:55.
Rev up your engines, folks. American Rentier Garage is putting on the brakes this season, ending the high...
KMED.
All righty. By the way, Joel just called me up and said, according to a friend of his that counted, Kamala lied 114 times in the debate, and Trump, of course, exaggerated the Afghanistan value. But, of course, I don't know if they're lies or exaggerations of the same thing or not. But yeah, I love that. I love it. 114 times. Wow. Thanks for counting. Hi, who's this? Good morning. Welcome.
Bill, this is SLM Brad.
Oh, Brad, how you doing? I didn't have a polka ready. I didn't know it was you. What's going on, buddy?
Sorry, buddy. Hey, off topic, I might have missed it, but how did your high school reunion go?
My high school reunion was absolutely wonderful. It really was. And it was great. I didn't really talk a whole lot about it after I got back, other than I was talking about the economics impact of it. And what was so fun about it, though, was getting together with people. Dave Kennard. Dave Kennard is a guy that I barely talked to back when I was in high school. And he was always kind of a shy, sort of an odd guy in his own way. And he's still an odd guy now. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
So some things hadn't changed. But I sat down, probably talked with him a half hour or more. We were talking about his stuff. And, you know, I'm ready to reach out to him. And I want to have stay in contact with him, because as much fun as I had talking with my best friend back then, Bob Orpin, I had a great time talking with David Kennard. And it was just great to touch back in with people who you had ignored even back in high school and meeting with that. So yeah. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful time. And what was even more interesting, in my opinion, was talking to, gosh, how do I put this, teachers. They had a couple of teachers actually show up at the at the reunion. There was Mrs. Fartarella, who was like a volleyball coach, and there was John Wall Robinstein. He's a farmer by trade, but he was a math and science teacher, and he was a great math and science teacher. I learned so much from him, and he ended up marrying my other calculus teacher, Mrs. Oney, or Miss Oney, she was at that time, and so they've been married, had kids, been very happy, and we're talking about it. And there was stuff that I'd forgotten about that these teachers remember about us. You just completely got run by from me. And Wal Robinstein, I think you'll laugh about this because my friend Bob was saying, Wal Robinstein said, Bill, I remember when you were sick for a couple of weeks and you were out of school for a couple of weeks. I think I had measles at that time. Measles or something. I was out with a serious fever for a couple of weeks and I was really sick. And then you came back into the science class, and then I asked you if you wanted to hold off on taking the quarterly exam. They were doing the big exam. And I said, no, I'll just take it right now. And I did better than my friend Bob Ortman, who was also another smart guy. And he says, yeah, and I was in the class all the time, and you beat me big time on that test. I'd completely forgotten about those kind of things. It's funny what people remember about you. It really is.
Isn't that great? I've got a classmate. The reason I bring it up, because yesterday was 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the Pentagon.
Oh, boy.
And he was less than 100 yards away from the nose of the plane that hit the building and survived.
He survived?
Yeah. Yeah, he's an amazing guy.
Oh my gosh! Yeah. Now, do you stay in touch with this gentleman?
You know, I do. You know, it's funny. He was a neighbor kid. We were like brothers growing up. As you know, you get older, we move in different directions. I stay in touch with him on Facebook with our class Facebook page.
Well,
he lives way on the other end of the world now, in Florida.
But still, aren't you glad you had a chance? And well, I'm really going to be reaching out to like Dave, like I had mentioned. Who was always kind of the shy, you know, oddball kid. Not weird, but just not particularly talkative. And I just found his experience as a truck driver. He was telling me about, you know, traveling around the country and his various things. And I'm sure maybe he's thinking he didn't have much influence at that high school reunion. But I'll tell you, he impacted me, and it was great getting to meet someone who I never really talked to back then, and it makes me kind of regret that I didn't talk to him more back in the day. Yeah.
So what year did you celebrate?
45th, oh. Man. Gotta go. Hey, but thanks for the call, all right?
This is
KMED, KMED HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KBXG, Grants Pass. We'll catch you Friday morning. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Deborah.
And this is our TimberTech story. We built the TimberTech deck. The deck floats into the landscape and looks like real wood. We did it all ourselves.
It was fun to just kind of figure it out. And we're